Good evening. The election hangs in the balance as Joe Biden widens his electoral lead over President Trump. The president's personal lawyer files a suit to open up the counting to more GOP supporters. The black vote, is there hope for Trump among young black men? And the nuclear football, Armageddon in the hands of one man. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Wednesday, November 4th, 2020. Holding signs that declared the people have spoken and we are the majority, weary protesters were on the streets of Washington, D.C. today as the nation holds its breath, waiting for the results of the presidential election. Marchers set off from D.C.'s Union Station just before noon to save democracy from a president they say has no respect for the voice of the people. They delivered a fake check to Fox News, chanting, "Trump lies, democracy dies." Outside the Republican National Committee, protesters faced a line of police and began to chant, "Count every vote. Every vote counts." The demonstration was organized by a coalition, including Shutdown DC. Activist Hope Nyer spoke with WBAI earlier today.
This morning, several groups within Shutdown DC, including representatives from Extinction Rebellion DC, Sunrise Movement, the Democratic Socialists of America DC, and then, of course, our usual contingent of local organizers from all sorts of groups were out and about, gathered in Black Lives Matter Plaza and at Union Station, and then went off a tour of the city showing support for democracy rather than support for Trump's enablers. I know that they visited Fox News and the RNC. Sunrise Movement members visited local council members as well, because even if the national election is the one that's getting all the coverage right now, local elections are a site to win a lot of victories and a place we need to fight hard as well.
What do you think of how it turned out last night?
Last night, we still got to have the celebration that we had hoped for, even if it wasn't necessarily, you know, in the location that we would have liked. Obviously, we faced a lot of resistance from MPD. We still had a good time, even if we were a little bit stopped by police action.
Do you expect that this is going to go for Biden by a small amount, or are you prepared for Trump winning?
You, I myself am too superstitious to say, but a lot of us are pretty hopeful. Some of us are more concerned. I think it goes both ways within the group, but we're all hoping for the same outcome.
What happens next if Biden does win?
If Biden does win, we take a breath, we regroup, we celebrate a little bit, and we go back to what we do best, which is organizing, working within our communities, building collective power, and working on a better future.
Heather Nyer is an activist with Shutdown DC, a coalition of groups determined to defend democracy, in their own words, as the vote count continues. And as tensions rise, with vote counting expected to last for days in some locations, WBAI will be closely following the results. Election reporter Chris Bangert-Drowns joins us with this live report.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me on. Look, as was expected, we didn't get a clear winner in yesterday's election. The Associated Press still has yet to call races in four key swing states. That's Georgia, Nevada, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. The AP currently calculates 264 electoral college votes for Biden compared to Trump's 214. The AP called Michigan for Biden literally minutes ago. If Biden wins victory in Nevada and gets those six electoral votes, Biden will have the necessary 270 electoral college votes to become president. He also leads in the popular vote by 3.1 million votes currently. In addition to picking up Nevada and winning the 270 votes, some polling experts think that Biden can build on that electoral college margin. Nate Cohn of New York Times has expressed confidence that Biden could still overtake Trump in Georgia and Pennsylvania. Most of the remaining uncounted ballots in those states are mail-in ballots, which we know to be favoring Biden heavily. I think it's in Philadelphia County that mail-in ballots are favoring Biden by a margin of 4-1. So if we have 15% of ballots left to be counted in Pennsylvania and those go to Biden 4-1, there's still a chance for Biden to retake the lead in Pennsylvania. Same is true in Georgia. So in short, what we saw yesterday could be considered what's called a red mirage, when more conservative-leaning voters tend to come out on election day, and we see this vast swath of mail-in and early votes being counted, superseding the conservative wave of votes on election day itself. To set some expectations for the coming hours and days, expect more concrete results from Maricopa County, Arizona, around 9 p.m. tonight. That's really the last stronghold of votes that need to get counted. AP has already called Arizona for Biden. more votes in Biden's favor will just solidify that. More outlets will probably call Michigan for Biden tonight. AP just did, CNN did earlier in the hour. As more mail-in ballots are counted, expect more outlets to call Michigan for Biden. Again, we said Nevada is the last state that Biden needs to win that 270 electoral votes. Nevada election officials had expressed that they will get a full count by tomorrow at noon, but have recently said that you can even expect results by tonight. So watch out for that. Now, Georgia and Georgia will also have some results tonight. Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger said that he would hope to have most ballots counted by tonight, but did not give a promise. Now, Pennsylvania and North Carolina are a little bit different. Pennsylvania votes are expected to be counted by Friday, so we have a few more days to wait on that. But the Pennsylvania margin for Trump has been diminishing significantly today. So expect that to continue. Expect that to get very close, or for Biden to edge out a victory in Pennsylvania. North Carolina mail-in ballots are accepted until November 12th. So we might need a week until we know what's going on in that state. Now, we know there are some legal challenges going on as well. Trump prematurely declared victory a little after 2 a.m. this morning, pledging to take the election to the Supreme Court. A lot of election law experts are throwing some cold water on the idea. They're saying it's unlikely courts would stop the counting of ballots received before or on Election Day and would only be able to nullify ballots received after Election Day. There being such a small, narrow segment of ballots eligible for nullification means that rescinding the Biden victories in Wisconsin and Michigan is highly unlikely. In addition to this, Trump has pledged a recount in Wisconsin. The margin is within one percentage point, so he's allowed to do that. This is also likely to fail. There was a recount in 2016, which netted Trump only 131 votes, nowhere near enough to overcome Biden's currently 20,000 vote lead in the state. The Trump campaign has also filed suit in Michigan and Pennsylvania to stop the counting of ballots and demand increased access to observing the counting process. Lastly, there's been a lot of talk of voter suppression and disinformation around this election. There were some reports of glitches with voting machines that created long lines for voters. There were also reports of some voter intimidation by poll watchers, one particularly in Hillsborough County, Florida, where two white men claimed to be deputies and questioned voters about who they were voting, specifically in a zone that was designated not for electioneering. So some truly felonious conduct there. But the biggest instance of disinformation was through calls and robocalls and texts. We have reports of calls in Michigan encouraging voters to vote today to avoid long lines tomorrow, when, of course, yesterday was the last day to vote. And then New York Attorney General Letitia James has issued subpoenas today to begin investigating an estimated 10 million robocalls that were sent out yesterday. So to summarize here, we have a handful of swing states too close to call. We can expect further results tonight and over the coming weeks. Biden has just a few more votes to win to get to that magic 270 number. But these legal challenges from Trump and the legal challenge from Letitia James around robocalls are also stuff to watch. Back to you, Paul.
Yes, thank you. Chris, let me ask you one question. Sure. Do you feel it's unusual for the president to declare a victory while the vote was still being counted and before all the states had called their own vote totals?
It's certainly unprecedented. And when he did that around 2 a.m. this morning, a number of news outlets and even some conservative folks came out and said, this is not something you should do. Chris Christie came out and denounced it. Ben Shapiro, of all people, came out and denounced it. So it really is unprecedented, but it's not truly surprising. Trump's been giving indications that he will legally challenge and throw doubt on the outcome of the election. So while unprecedented, this presidency is unprecedented, and so this action is unsurprising.
All right, great. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you.
Chris Bangert-Drowns joining us with a live report. And Trump won states that accounted for 306 electoral votes in 2016. He needs to win 269 electoral votes to tie and 270 or more to win in 2020. Meanwhile, in Michigan, Trump supporters and Democratic observers converged on a ballot counting center to monitor poll workers trying to finish counting more than 170,000 absentee ballots in Detroit, the state's largest city. Observers from both sides were not allowed to enter because the site reached the maximum number of challengers allowed. The situation grew heated with arguments breaking out between the challengers, election officials, and the Detroit police. In Philadelphia, Trump's personal lawyer, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, announced a bevy of lawsuits demanding more access to the vote count and a recount in Wisconsin, a state already called for Biden.
And this is among one of the most anti-democratic things I've ever seen or encountered. And it's not just here in Philadelphia. This is going on all over the country. We have filed a lawsuit. The lawsuit actually required that when these mail-in ballots that you know are highly suspicious anyway, this form of balloting has always been considered the most prone to fraud. That's according to the New York Times when it didn't apply to candidate President Trump. Well, we were supposed to be allowed by law to observe the counting of the ballots. Now, observe means to any intelligent person being able to look at it. The way it's interpreted by the Democrat crooked machine of Philadelphia is that the observers can be 20 or 30 feet away, never able to see the ballot itself, never able to see if it was properly postmarked, properly addressed, properly signed on the outside. All the things that often lead to disqualification of ballots or make it very easy to dump 50,000 totally fraudulent ballots because they're not observed. This went on for 20 hours. So we went back to court and we went before a Democrat judge. No need to tell you what the result in Philadelphia is if you're before a Democrat judge. Obviously a political hack who doesn't know the meaning of the word observe. Joe Biden could have voted 50 times, as far as we know, or 5,000 times. The ballots could be from Camden. And we're going to go look at just how many dead people voted here. And you have a reputation for people being bussed in from Camden voting here. But this goes way beyond any of that. We have exactly the same lawsuit in Wisconsin, where exactly the same thing happened. Except in Wisconsin, mysteriously at 4 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning, about 120,000 ballots appeared. Oh, here come these ballots. Well, we have no idea if they really are ballots. We have no idea if they're signed, if they're postmarked properly, if it isn't just the same person who submitted 100,000 ballots, and they all got counted. This is the way they intend to win. Now I'm informed by former Congressman Sweeney, who's been going around the country collecting this information, that similar situation in Arizona, similar situation in Nevada, and a similar situation, what am I missing, John? Where are you? In Michigan, in Detroit, Michigan. Again, let me be specific what it is. This whole new thing that never happened before in our country, these mail-in ballots, which has been a cause of real concern for everyone because they can easily be fraudulent. Well, one of the things that the law attaches to that is the right for both parties to observe.
And that's former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani. He's a personal lawyer for President Trump. Ballots delivered early this morning in Wisconsin were from the city of Milwaukee. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro says the lawsuit is more a political document than a legal document. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Donald Trump and Joe Biden may be slugging it out in the Midwest, fighting for every vote in states where the difference between the two is razor thin. But both red and blue voters were united on one issue. On the ballot in states across the country, legalization of marijuana, and in a larger context, the legal demolition of the decades-long war on drugs. Ballot measures pass in Arizona, Mississippi, Montana, New Jersey, and South Dakota, adding to the 33 states that already allow it for medical or recreational purposes. Oregon will be the first state in the country to decriminalize the personal possession of all drugs, including heroin and cocaine. And in Washington, D.C., a ballot initiative to decriminalize the use of magic mushrooms and other psychedelic substances had a commanding lead. The director of the New York chapter of the Drug Policy Alliance is Melissa Moore. She says New Jersey's measure puts pressure on New York to finalize a cannabis legalization bill in the works for years, and decriminalizing pot in Mississippi opens a crack in the Solid South's wall against pot legalization.
Mississippi approved medical marijuana, which is really important to have within the South for people who need their medicine to be able to have that access. Same in South Dakota in terms of medical marijuana moving through yesterday. And then for adult use legalization, we had Arizona, Montana, and New Jersey. Of course, New Jersey being probably the most relevant for us in New York in terms of just the proximity and, you know, establishing yet another legal market that New Yorkers will be able to access incredibly easily, even more so than Massachusetts, you know, our close neighbor that established legalization a couple of years ago. And we've seen a lot of New Yorkers flocking to Massachusetts to take advantage of that over the last couple of years. But certainly as New Jersey comes online, the ballot initiative that passed yesterday was basically an up or down vote where voters approved legalization. And now it kicks back to the legislature for them to actually pass the bill that will establish the framework for what that program will look like. It really does put the pressure on New York in terms of our timeline for legalization. But I will say we still have a chance to be able to not only legalize in New York and do so relatively quickly as the legislative session will kick off in January, but also to do so in a way that really is the national model for what legalization could look like. I mean, so far, especially within ballot initiatives in other states, there's less of an opportunity to develop the specific framework for what the adult use market will be compared to being able to do that within a piece of legislation like we have with the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act in New York. And so, you know, with the leadership of the majority leader on the assembly side, Crystal Peoples Stokes, and Senator Liz Krueger, the MRTA has really been crafted in a way to establish New York as a national model of what marijuana justice can look like and to be responsive to the sorts of harms that have been caused to communities under prohibition.
I noticed there were legalization of drugs was on the ballot in one in certain states, legalization of magic mushrooms. It seems to be, and by large, you know, you're talking about 65-68% better than either Biden or Trump did in the same states.
Yeah, Oregon passed Measure 110, which decriminalizes drugs and establishes access to treatment, actually based on cannabis tax revenues as the source of funding there. But I think you're absolutely right that what we're seeing is the real dismantling of the war on drugs in real time. You know, for a long time, people have been talking about how the war on drugs is harmful and really delineating what the specifics of that has been in terms of the targeting of specific communities, mostly Black and Latinx folks, for drug charges and the injustice baked into the war on drugs from its very inception. And now what we're seeing is the tide turning and not just rejecting some of the criminalization around marijuana, which has been the conversation for quite a long time, but going much further than that and saying, you know, if we're saying that criminalization is an inappropriate response for marijuana, then it's also an inappropriate response for other drugs. And it's far time that we move on from locking people up and ruining people's lives and having the myriad other consequences that people face across the board in terms of housing and education and employment, child welfare, because of the drug war, and instead saying, like, no, we're going to take an approach to this entire issue in this country.
Melissa Moore is director of the New York chapter of the Drug Policy Alliance. While a majority of Latino voters supported Democrat Joe Biden nationally, President Donald Trump was able to cut into that support in some competitive states like Florida and Nevada. Nationally, Biden earned support from roughly two-thirds of Latino voters, while Trump got the backing of about a third. In winning Florida, Trump was aided by Cuban voters who support his policies towards Venezuela and Cuba. In Nevada, Biden received support from just about half of Latinos, but in Arizona, by comparison, 18% of the electorate was Latino, and they backed Biden by a wide margin with 59% of the vote. Black voters strongly backed Biden, often referring to the coronavirus pandemic as the nation's biggest problem, while mostly white Trump supporters pegged the economy as their greatest concern. Black women in Georgia showed up, voting for the Biden-Harris ticket by an overwhelming 94%. The vote among black men was closer, however. the somewhat greater support by black men for Trump, as some pundits believing that Trump has broadened his base from racial grievance to class grievance. Refused fascism organizer Carl Dix, a black radical activist who was jailed for refusing the draft during the Vietnam War, has been writing on how some black celebrities have given support to Trump.
Don't think it's a class thing. First off, we have to look at the numbers and see how things really broke, because I haven't seen the final numbers, but I will still stand by what I said earlier, which is that black people are probably the demographic who voted most heavily against Trump, even if there was a fall down from the numbers from the previous election. Now, in relation to the gender gap, that I think has to do with some of the men who feel Trump talk about his tiger energy. And frankly, that tiger energy is toxic masculinity. It's patriarchy. And black men, just like any other men, need to break with that. We need to see that somebody who thinks he can grab women by the genitals because he's a celebrity, who looks at black women and sees monsters and empty barrels and all the other things that he's called them, is somebody that we should not unite with, because that is a wrong approach towards women. Women are a bit more than half of humanity, and that's how they need to be looked at, as human beings. Now, in terms of Ice Cube, Lil Wayne, Lil Weezy, and some of the rest of them, there is some class aspect in the sense of, well, actually not so much Ice Cube. Some of the other rappers, though, looked at it and 50 Cent actually said, he's keeping my taxes low. Then he backed off of it after he got a lot of flack. But what was clear with him was, what is in it for this black man? And then there has also long been a view, which seems to be gaining some steam right now, that you got to talk to the people in power and see what they will do to help change the situation for black people. And what I said in my interviews around this and writing, and what Bob Avakian says in his article on Kanye West and Ice Cube, is that this approach is wrong twice. It's wrong in that saying in approaching Donald Trump what's in it for black people is ignoring that this is a guy who put immigrants in concentration camps and tore children from their parents' arms, a guy who is targeting a woman's right to choose to have an abortion, who's targeting LGBTQ rights. And even if this guy was going to do something for black people, it is not in the interest of humanity to throw him a lifeline to help him in the midst of an upcoming election. That's one way they're wrong. But the other way they're wrong is, this is Donald Trump. Donald Trump ain't going to do anything good for black people. He's done bad things for black people his whole life. We could take it back to the Central Park Five and how he wanted to see them executed while they were being framed up. And then even after they were exonerated, he said they should still be in jail. We could even go beyond that to when he and his father discriminated against black people in their housing projects. We can come more up to today when he looked at the Nazis and Klansmen in Charlottesville, Virginia, and saw many fine people among these people, some of whom were saying the Civil War, in the U.S. Civil War, the wrong side won. This is not a man to look to for something good for black people. And if he told you he was going to do something good for black people, he was being Donald Trump, which is to say he was lying.
Refused fascism organizer Carl Dix. Last week, Ice Cube told Fox News' Chris Wallace that he was not yet decided who to vote for, but expressed that he seeks to work with the winner to help the black community. He's never endorsed Donald Trump. And President Trump's alarming claims of victory in Pennsylvania, Georgia, North Carolina, and Michigan, although the races in those states have not been decided yet, has led some election followers to question the president's emotional stability. And, of course, Michigan has been decided just moments ago. In one tweet, he said Republicans are up big and accused the Democrats of trying to steal the election, claiming bizarrely that votes cannot be cast after the polls are closed. That claim led to Twitter putting an alert on Trump's tweet warning of misinformation. The alert reads, "Some or all of the content shared in this tweet is disputed and might be misleading about an election or other civic process." All this could be chalked up to election night jitters, but the awesome power of the president has flashed a warning. A reminder, all presidents have the singular power to launch nuclear weapons. The director of policy for the Anti-Nuclear Plowshares Fund is Tom Colina.
Every president has that authority until Inauguration Day. So President Trump will have the authority single-handedly to launch U.S. nuclear weapons until January 20th next year, when he hands off or retains, depending on who wins, the authority to do that. So he will have it at least for the next few months until January 20. Of course, if he wins, then he'll keep it for the next 4 years. After that,
what is the extent of the U.S. nuclear arsenal? What is it that he actually can send if he decides to do that?
The president of the United States has the sole authority, which means he can decide for himself without approval from anybody else, not from Congress, the Pentagon, or anyone, to launch the full U.S. nuclear arsenal of up to 4,000 nuclear weapons, way more than enough to destroy the world. We essentially give, as the American people, one person, and whatever your views of President Trump, he's fallible. He makes mistakes, just like any human does. So we are giving the power to destroy the world to one fallible human. And so we have to ask ourselves, why are we doing this? And we've been doing this for 75 years. Since President Truman took that authority for himself in 1945. There's no good reason for this. There's no national security case to be made for why this is a good idea. It's just the way we've always done it.
Why did the United States decide to give all that power to one person?
In 1945, President Truman, no one gave it to him. He took it for himself. At the time, the bomb had just been used for the first time in Japan, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, by the military. And President Truman didn't feel really involved in that decision. He was kind of on the outskirts of that decision making. So when he saw the human destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, over 200,000 people killed instantly, he decided that he wanted to take that control. And so he said that no third bomb will be used unless I, the president of the United States, specifically authorizes it. And sole authority was born. President Truman didn't trust the military at that time to have enough restraint in the use of nuclear weapons.
We have a president now who is already showing signs of strain, I'll put it gently, because of the fact that he might lose. What happens if the president has a nervous breakdown?
It's a real possibility. I certainly hope that doesn't happen. But the mere fact we're even talking about it, you know, raises the issue of why do we put ourselves in this situation, right? Any president could have a nervous breakdown. Any president and presidents have been under the influence of alcohol when they've had this authority. President Trump was just in the hospital where he was under serious medications for COVID-19 that had a mood altering effect. And he had the authority to launch nuclear weapons, even though he was under the power of mood-altering drugs. None of this makes any sense. None of it is really protecting the security of the American people in the way that it should. And this is a risk that is there, it's real, and we simply don't have to take it.
How about first strike? So there's no fear anymore of the old-fashioned first strike where they'll just decapitate the whole government of the United States and force us to surrender?
We have nuclear weapons well dispersed on submarines at sea, which are invulnerable. and on airplanes. Even if we lost some, for example, our land-based ballistic missiles in a surprise first strike, which, by the way, is highly unlikely, we would be able to retaliate with our submarine weapons at sea. And that really kind of underlines the point here is that there's no one that has a reason or an incentive to strike the United States first. If Russia were to strike the United States first, they know full well that the United States nuclear forces would devastate Russia. And so Russia has no incentive to attack the United States first for the same reason the United States has no incentive to attack Russia first.
Tom Colina, the director of policy for the Anti-Nuclear Plowshares Fund. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, November 4th, 2020. The news was produced by Linda Perry and Chris Bangert-Drowns. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.